Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the International History Institute at Boston University and featuring Harvard University professor Jeffrey Frieden. Professor Frieden's lecture is titled The Short American Century, 1941 to 2008, Contrasting Views of the Era of American Dominance. We begin with an introduction by Boston University professor of History and International Relations, Andrew Basevich.
We are trying to see the recent past as history, and in order to do that, we are declaring the recent past to be in the past. We are positing that there is an identifiable historical period that we can legitimately call the American century, a period in which the United States exercises some kind of a role of global dominion. We are stipulating that that period began in 1941, more or less at the time that the United States entered World War II, and we're stipulating for the sake of discussion that it ended in 2008 with the defeat of the Republican candidate, the defeat of George W. Bush's designated successor, and in that sense, the repudiation of George W. Bush's foreign policies, focused in particular on a global war on terror. That combined, of course, with the greatest economic crisis the country has faced since the Great Depression. So the question is, what do we make of this short American century? What was it about? What can we learn from this period, which we are now saying is distinctly in the past? It may not be in the past, but that's the premise of this lecture series. And tonight, we're just pleased and delighted to have Professor Jeffrey Frieden with us. Professor Frieden is the Stanfield Professor of International Peace at Harvard University. He is a specialist in the politics of international monetary and financial relations. He's the author of several books, among them Global Capitalism, Its Fall and Rise in the 20th Century, Debt, Development, and Democracy, Modern Political Economy in Latin America, 1965-1985, and Banking on the World, The Politics of American International Finance. He's also the co-editor of many books on related topics. His articles on the politics of international economic issues have appeared in a wide variety of scholarly and general interest publications. Tonight, the title of his presentation is America in the World Economy, From the American Century to Globalization. You're welcome, and we're so glad you could be with us this evening.
Thank you, Andy. It's a great pleasure to be here and to talk about a topic that I think is on many people's minds these days, America and the world economy. In fact, in the current environment, we live in a world in which the world economy appears unpredictable, unstable, worrisome, troubling, and it is perhaps natural that in this environment there's a certain nostalgia for a bygone era in which the international economy appeared more stable, more predictable, more controlled, more reliable, more less worrisome on every dimension. Those, in some ways, were the days of a world in which the U.S. unilaterally led the world economy, largely unilaterally led the world economy, in which the U.S. was economically predominant, and in which the structure of the international economy was one which had largely been devised under American leadership during the 1940s. So it is perhaps natural that people look back to that era, which was a relatively successful period in the international economy, with some nostalgia. But one of the messages I want to transmit today is that we are not anymore in that international economy, and we're probably not going back. We probably haven't been there since sometime between the 70s and the early 90s. The world economy between the 1940s and the 70s, 80s, I have a somewhat different periodization, I guess I should say, than Andy. The world economy between the 40s and the 80s had very unusual features, many of them not seen before in international economic affairs, and most of them probably unlikely to be seen since then, certainly not seen today. So what I want to do today is start by describing some of the main characteristics of the world economy during that short American century that Andy talked about, and then spend some time trying to explain why the world economy looked as it did in that period, and end up asking what happened to it, why did it go away, What has replaced it, and what are the prospects for the future? What do we have to learn from the history of the short American century in the world economy? First, some, I think, very important background, both historical and economic. We take for granted that we live in an era of globalization in which people and capital and goods and ideas, technologies, and other things move relatively freely around the world. But in this audience, perhaps, it will not be news to point out that this is not the first era of globalization, that for many, many decades, even generations in the 19th and early 20th century, the world economy was, generally speaking, on most dimensions, as integrated as it is today. Now, scholars argue back and forth as to whether the world economy today is more globalized than it was 100 years ago, because scholars are paid to argue. And on some dimensions, it was probably less integrated then than it is now. And on other dimensions, it's more was more integrated then. But roughly speaking, there's no question that the world economy between the middle part of the 19th century and 1914 was globalized by virtually any standard. Not only was it tightly integrated, but there it marked some extraordinary successes. The most rapid pace of economic growth in all of preceding history. The world economy grew more in those 75 years than it had in the previous 750. Poor countries caught up with middle-income countries. Middle-income countries caught up with rich countries. There was a great environment of general macroeconomic stability. There were recessions and crises, but they were overcome. Unemployment, generally speaking, was relatively low. The pace of growth was relatively rapid. So this was an era that was, by most measures, successful. Now, I don't want to discount all of the problems of the age, from colonialism to periodic recessions to the lack of labor and other rights in many of the societies of the era. But from a purely economic standpoint, and certainly by comparison with what came before, this was a successful episode in the international economic experience. And yet, it all came crashing down in the space of a few weeks in 1914, once the war began. Not only that, but for the next 30 years, it could not be restored. Despite continuing attempts to rebuild an open international economy, starting immediately after World War I ended, nothing worked. Conferences, treaties, international institutions, organizations, attempt after attempt failed. The world economy spiraled downward, eventually into depression, trade and currency wars, and World War II. Right. So in a sense, there is an important lesson to be gleaned from the experience of that previous era of globalization before 1914 and the interwar years. And that great lesson is that the world economy, an open international economy, is not self-regulating and self-enforcing. Markets may be self-regulating, but an integrated international economy is not. Right? It can arise and it can collapse. And when it collapses, it is almost always, certainly in our experience, because of the failure of cooperation among national governments. Right? So to turn it around and make it a little bit more positive, the maintenance of an open international economy depends upon cooperation among the major economic powers. That's the first lesson from both the positive experience before 1914 and the negative experience of the interwar years. And a second very important lesson related to the first is that that cooperation will not be forthcoming unless there is domestic political support for engagement with the world economy. Right? If the domestic public doesn't support involvement in the international economic order, countries, governments will not make the sacrifices necessary to maintain that commitment, and cooperation will not ensue. And that's really what happened in the interwar years. So that's a sort of a backdrop to what I want to talk about today. But it's an important backdrop, because what the experience demonstrated is that we can't take those preconditions for granted. We can't take for granted the notion that countries will cooperate to maintain an open international economy. And we can't take for granted that there will be domestic support for engagement with the international economy. In many ways, the big story of that short American century that we're talking about tonight is that the preconditions for economic integration, for what we would now call globalization, were forthcoming in the 1940s, in the late 1940s, when just a few years before they had been entirely absent. 10 years before the post-war American-led open international economic order began to be constructed, there was almost universal agreement that such a thing was neither desirable nor possible. So what happened? How did this turn of events come to pass? And why did it come to pass? Well, let me start by describing some of the defining characteristics of the world economy as it emerged from the late 1940s and as it persisted, generally speaking, depending on how you want to periodize it, through the 70s or 80s. By the 90s, it's pretty clear that we were in a new order, which I'll talk about. But from the 40s, let's say through the early 1990s, this is the international economic order that typically is known to scholars as the Bretton Woods order. Right. Now, the first characteristic of this international economic order, a unique characteristic, one that had never before characterized any international economic order, was that it was designed and planned and implemented consciously. That is, that people, representatives of governments, policymakers, sat down around a table, as it were, in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, at a meeting that lasted for almost 2 years, and planned what the international economy was going to look like, what the monetary order was going to look like, what the financial order was going to look like, what the trading order was going to look like. Right? That had never been done before. The world economy of the mercantilist era, the world economy of the classical gold standard era, had emerged out of the independent policies of independent nation states. But in 1943, the major allies, led by the British and the Americans, led by their representatives, the Treasury representative from the U.S., Harry Dexter White, Treasury representative from the U.K., John Maynard Keynes, sat down in Bretton Woods, Mount Washington, and designed what they thought the world economy should look like after the war was over. And in a remarkable number of ways, the world economy that developed over the next 15 or 20 years looked a lot like what they had designed. So it was designed by policymakers and implemented by governments. Along with this, it was structured around international institutions, intergovernmental institutions inhabited by national governments, powerful international institutions. There have been international institutions before, Postal and Telecommunications Union and even the League of Nations and the Bank for International Settlements, but they didn't have a lot of power. These new international economic institutions turned out, in most analyses, to have a lot of power. The International Monetary Fund, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the World Bank, and in trade, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which has since transmogrified into the World Trade Organization. Three relatively powerful, very important international institutions, again, designed, got sort of not, but roughly speaking, designed by policymakers at the Bretton Woods negotiations. So the first characteristic is designed and planned by governments and implemented around multilateral international institutions. The second characteristic, which is one that we're all familiar with, I think because of the aftermath of this era, is that it was predicated on the supposition that there was a common goal, at least among the advanced industrial countries, of carrying out a generalized reduction in trade barriers, a generalized reduction in barriers to international investment, international financial flows. That is, to try to move from an era in the 1930s in which trade was pretty much dead in the water, in which international investment had almost stopped completely, and international finance was actually moving backwards. That is, there was net negative international financial flows as people repaid their debts. To move away from that towards an era in which trade barriers were reduced and international trade would grow, investment was encouraged, and financial flows were encouraged. So that was the general goal of the era, and that's what characterized the era, a generalized reduction in barriers to international economic activity. Third important characteristic, and perhaps in many ways the most crucial characteristic from a political and economic standpoint, was that the Bretton Woods order was predicated upon a commitment to gradualism and compromise. Unlike the classical gold standard era, which said governments on the gold standard, governments in this environment make a commitment to put their international economic commitments first, their international economic requirements first, and to make the domestic economy conform to the requirements of involvement in the international economy. The Bretton Woods system went in a very different direction. In large part on the basis of the experience of the interwar period, there was a general agreement that while liberalization, while openness was desirable, it could only be attained if it was done gradually, and it could only be attained if it was done in a compromised manner, in a way that compromised with national, social, economic, and political goals. So, for example, the movement towards reducing trade barriers was extremely slow. Right? Gradually, a series of multilaterally negotiated rounds starting in 1947 and running all the way through the late 1960s. It took 20, 25 years before trade barriers were reduced back down to the levels that had prevailed before 1914. So gradual trade liberalization and many, many exceptions. Right? Rather than say we believe in open trade, We believe in removing barriers to trade, as the free traders in Britain in the 1840s had said, well, we're going to liberalize what we can. The most contentious area of world trade is farm trade, trade in agricultural products. So we're going to leave that off the agenda. We're not even going to discuss it. We're going to allow countries to impose trade barriers when they face emergencies. We're not going to really define emergencies. We're going to let countries define that themselves. There's going to be a norm that you only impose trade barriers if you're facing extreme circumstances. And we're going to allow developing countries to impose trade barriers if they feel they need to do so for developmental purposes. Right? There was a general desire for the integration of capital markets, but there was also an expectation that capital movements would be tightly controlled by governments. Right? Every country in the Bretton Woods system, including the United States, had capital controls. That is, had restrictions on the extent to which people could move capital across borders, could invest across borders. Right? So there are lots and lots of compromises made along the way. In an important sense, the whole system was based on one crucial central compromise, which again came out of the experience of the interwar period. And that was a compromise between the desirability of general openness to the international economy and the desirability of national macroeconomic and economic policy autonomy. That is, the Bretton Woods system was based on the idea that countries should be integrated with one another and should trade more or less freely, invest more or less freely with one another, but that none of that should impede the ability of national authorities to carry out their own macroeconomic policies, including, crucially, to create a nationally responsive welfare state. This is implicit in all of the agreements signed and explicit in some of them. So the Bretton Woods system was not an undying commitment to open economic borders. It was a series of compromises driven in a large sense by the biggest compromise of all, the notion that you could put together an open world economy with a welfare state and national macroeconomic, monetary, and fiscal policy independence. Right? The emblematic of this compromise, this is a little bit of my own particular interest, as Andy says, I work on international monetary and financial relations, but it is the case that the monetary order that came out of Bretton Woods is emblematic of the set of compromises. It was a gold dollar system which combined aspects of the gold standard from before 1914 with aspects of what Keynes called the new principles of managed currencies. Right? So the U.S. dollar was linked to gold at an unchanging rate, $35 per ounce, and other currencies were linked to the U.S. dollar. But they could change. Other currencies could move their exchange rates around as necessary. Again, no one ever defined what was necessary. What the Articles of Agreement of the IMF say is, in cases of fundamental disequilibria, countries can change their exchange rate. No definition. So they did it sort of whenever they felt it was crucially important. It turned out to be every 5 to 7 years. Right? By the same token, the IMF was predicated on the desirability of open international investment. But it also actually required that countries impose capital controls to restrict what were then called hot money flows, speculative capital movements. Right? So the monetary order embedded within itself this attempt to find a compromise between the gold standard and the closure of the interwar period. On the one hand, the commitment to a gold-dollar exchange rate that couldn't be changed. On the other hand, the right and responsibility of national authorities to vary their currency's values as they saw necessary. So that's the general characteristics of the world economy in this short American century. And one has to say, looking back, that this was, again, extraordinarily successful. I said before that the period before 1914 was the period of the most rapid growth in all previous world history. Well, the Bretton Woods system was even more impressive. Overall economic growth on a per capita basis was about double what it had been in the 19th and early 20th century. So we can say that it, up until even today, the Bretton Woods era had the most rapid economic growth in all of world history. Average tariffs were reduced very dramatically, gradually but dramatically, reaching about an average rate of under 10% by the late 1960s. International investment, after a few years of slow growth, started growing very rapidly. International financial growth grew very rapidly. And the Bretton Woods system really set us on the path that we are still on today towards an integrated world economy, towards our current level of globalization. So on many dimensions, it was a very successful experience. But now I want to ask why it happened. Again, remember I started by saying that very few might have anticipated in 1945, 46, 47 that we would have gone to a system that had, with really a great deal of consensus, arrived at an open international economy based on the experience of the 1930s. So why was such a transition possible? Why was that movement possible? As indicated even by the short American century notion, the U.S. role is central. So we need to start with what's going on in the U.S. The U.S. really defined the terms of debate over what the world economy should look like in this period. So let's start with the U.S. Now, the principal question to ask here, I think, is why was the United States willing to play this role in the late 1940s? And it's easy to look back and say, well, I mean, it's clear the U.S. was the predominant economy in the world, and we were supporters of free trade, and so why wouldn't we have been? But none of that was clear at the time. Remember, after all, that the American role in the world economy in 1946 or 1947 was roughly equivalent to the American role in the world economy in 1919. Predominant, the biggest lender in the world, the biggest trading nation in the world, the biggest industrial power in the world, the determinant of the terms of the peace, the designer of the post-war international institutions, right? And yet after World War I, the U.S. did not, in fact, participate in the management and design of an open international economy. And even as World War II ended, I think it is little appreciated how unpopular things like free trade and international economic openness were in the United States. Remember, in 1946, the Republicans swept the House and Senate and were widely, universally expected to win the presidency in 1948. And this was the Republican Party that was still dominated by its Taft isolationist wing, that is, by people who had opposed all of the Roosevelt-era movements towards freer trade, towards international, we're trying to get international finance going, things along those lines. So it seemed that the country was turning back towards the kind of economic isolationism that had characterized it in the interwar period in the 1920s and early 1930s. So perhaps some have suggested the country had learned the lessons of the Depression. That is, there's a story about the Smoot-Hawley Tariff of 1930, which was one of the highest tariffs in American history, being blamed for the depth and breadth of the Great Depression. And so people had learned from that lesson and decided to move away from it. Well, there's a very easy test of that. Many of the congressmen and senators who voted for the Smoot-Hawley Tariff were still in office when proposals for liberalizing trade policy came before them, right? And 96% of them voted exactly as they had on the Smoot-Hawley Tariff. 96% of the people who voted for the Smoot-Hawley Tariff voted against liberalization in subsequent years, right? And 96% of those who voted for it voted for. So at least the congressmen and senators, maybe that doesn't say much, but at least they weren't learning any lessons from the Great Depression. Maybe there was some sudden bout of good sense or some new consensus about openness had developed. To some extent, there was probably more agreement on this in 1945 than there had been in 1920, but still American public opinion was quite hostile. Right? At no time in the late 40s and early 50s did free trade, when you asked people, are you for free trade or against it, did free trade get a majority within public opinion? And in every public opinion poll taken by Gallup in this five or so year period, the plurality, there were, most people said they didn't know, but a plurality of opinion between a third and a half or so of public opinion said that the United States had gone too far in concerning itself with problems in other parts of the world. So public opinion hadn't really shifted that much. Right? So we have to ask why. I think there are some important economic changes that help explain why the U.S. position in the international economy and its attitude towards the world economy had changed. One is that most of our competitors' economies were in shambles. So industries that had previously faced a lot of competition now didn't have to worry about that. I mean, the chemical industry is an example. The chemical industry had been one of the most protectionist in the country. It faced mostly German import competition. There wasn't any German chemical industry left, so they became free traders, right, on the Bismarck principle that free trade is the weapon of the strong. But there are also multinational corporations that developed over the previous 25 or so years, and so there were a lot of American corporations that had developed international interests. But I think that's only a very partial part of the story, a very partial component of the change and of the story. A very crucial difference from what had happened before was non-economic. Was really geopolitical more than anything else. And that was that people in the U.S. who had previously been hostile to economic internationalism, as it was called, towards trade liberalization, towards more involvement in the world economy, started to see that economic integration as an important component part of cementing a Western anti-Soviet alliance. Right? As a geopolitical imperative that had not existed before. Now, you can see this as either ideological or coalitional. In an ideological sense, to some extent, the commitment to an open international economy by the Truman administration, by the policy planners at state and other American policymakers, was sold to the American politics, to the American public, as part of a general commitment to an American-led anti-Soviet alliance. And it made sense. It makes logical sense. Can't very well expect the Western Europeans and the Japanese to cooperate with us on military and diplomatic matters if we keep their goods out of our markets and if we don't allow them to participate in our capital market, to borrow from us and to sell to us. So there's a certain sense to that. There's also a sort of a coalitional logic as well, which we see in a lot of the debates in the period. There were people in Congress, led especially in the Republican Party, led by Senator Vandenberg, who was the leader of the Republican majority, was the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, who was, if not hostile, unenthusiastic about the Bretton Woods agreements, unenthusiastic about trade liberalization, unenthusiastic about any of these economic measures, but very concerned about the spread of communism and very concerned about about Soviet influence both in the world generally and in Western Europe. And Vandenberg met frequently with Marshall, Acheson, and others from the administration, from the Truman administration, and came to agree with them that this set of economic policies was a crucial component part of building a strong Western alliance. So unlike in 1919, in 1946, 47, 48, the economic policies of the U.S., America's role in the world economy, was seen as part of a grand compromise and a grand commitment to play a leading role, not just in the world economy, but in international diplomatic affairs, and in particular, in leading the Western world against the Soviet Union and, more generally, communism. Right. So that's I think, the large part of the American story. The shift is partly economic, but also part of a broader geopolitical change in the American orientation. So, to be sure, American leadership was crucial when we start with that. But, and it may even be the case that all you really need to do at some level is invoke the use of American predominance, of brute force, of the powers of persuasion, in this short American century of such short Americans as Harry Truman or Clare Booth Luce or others who used American influence in many ways as a cudgel to try to convince countries or groups within countries to sign on to the American project. But I think that's really, really too simple-minded. I think that it's almost certainly the case, although we can't rerun history, it's almost certainly the case that the creation of the post-war economic order, of the Bretton Woods system, really relied upon, could not have taken place without willing European participation, right? That the U.S. needed the principal European powers, the U.K., France, and eventually Germany, and eventually also Japan and Italy, to willingly sign on to a commitment to involvement in this American-led international economy, right? And it's certainly the case that America's eagerness for cooperation now, as against the 1920s, helped the Europeans to sign on. But there were also a number of developments within the European political economies that a more general political and economic reorientation in the European countries that played a major role as well. So think back again to the early post-World War II period and think of the changes that had ensued over the interwar years, right? What had happened, first with the 30s, then with the war, in the early post-war period, on the one hand, was that the extreme right had been lopped off from the legitimate political spectrum. Right? And as the Cold War developed, the extreme left was also lopped off. And these were the two principal supporters of what we in the international economic biz call autarky. Right, that is national self-sufficiency, turning inward on a national economy, the opponents of economic integration. In the European political space, really from the 19th century onward, the principal supporters of economic integration, of trade liberalization, things along those lines, were the moderate Christian Democrats and the moderate Social Democrats. And the principal opponents were the extremists on the right and on the left. And that's where Europe went. Most of Europe, right? Most of the 1930s, 20s, and 30s went in the extreme directions. All of Southern, Central, and Eastern Europe, at some point between 1920 and 1938, opted for autarky, opted for national self-sufficiency under the guise typically of the fascists or Nazis or militarists of one sort or another in the Soviet Union under the communists. And there was very strong support for this all throughout the period. In fact, looking at Europe at the time, you might have assumed that this was the wave of the future. It turned out that because of the war and because of the Cold War, the extreme right and the extreme left and the economic bases of those political forces, that is, the small farmers and small businessmen who had been the principal supporters of the fascists and the industrial working class, the principal supporters of the communists, were essentially removed from power and were not going to be in power. And that left the centrist part of the political spectrum, right, from moderate social democracy to moderate Christian democracy, who had pretty much always been more favorably inclined towards economic integration. So there was a general agreement within that consensus on the desirability of openness, of the welfare state, on this kind of gradualist middle ground that avoided the extreme policies of the interwar period. In a certain sense, the Bretton Woods system was an international expression of that kind of centrist consensus, right? Just as most of the political economies of Western Europe and North America over the course of the 20 years leading up to the late 40s had, in one way or another, come to agree upon the desirability both of moderate integration in the world economy and a welfare state, the Bretton Woods system accepted both of those commitments. The Bretton Woods system was, in many ways, the international recognition of the centrist consensus that emerged after World War II. All right. So the international economy between the 40s and the 80s, let's say, was a product of the convergence of interests among the principal Western and Japan and Australia, New Zealand, the principal industrial nations under American leadership. Convergence of interest, convergence on the desirability of a generally open international economy, convergence on the desirability of national macroeconomic management and the welfare state, convergence on the desirability of a broad anti-Soviet, anti-communist coalition. And again, as I say, it was an enormously successful system, but it began to decay over the course of the 70s and 80s, and that leads to then my next question, which is why did the system end? What was it that brought about the end, the shortness of this short American economic century? I think the simple story is that success undermined the Bretton Woods system. Right? The Bretton Woods system, as I said, was predicated on gradualism and compromise. The success of the system led to extraordinary advances in the level of international economic integration and ever higher levels of connections among the economies of the world. And as the economies of the world became more and more integrated, it became harder to sustain the Bretton Woods compromise. Right? That is, the model of gradualism and compromise was much easier to sustain when the world economy was only marginally integrated, was only mildly integrated, than it has been over the last 20 years as the world economy becomes more and more integrated on many, many dimensions. Again, I'll draw my principal example from the monetary order. Right? I said before the monetary system, the Bretton Woods monetary order, the gold dollar system, was predicated on capital controls. And the reason it was predicated on capital controls was that the designers of the system, those who implemented it, understood that you didn't want speculators to be speculating against currencies all the time. If the currencies were going to be fixed against the dollar, you had to control speculation. The way to control speculation was to make it difficult or impossible for people to move money from country to country in a matter of minutes or seconds, certainly for speculative purposes. They encouraged long-term investments, but they either discouraged or prohibited short-term speculative movements. Right? And that worked remarkably well over the course of the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. But over the course of the 1970s into the 80s, the international financial system began to recover, and it began to recover with things that we now take for granted, like electronic fund transfers, like 24-hour trading, like markets open around the world in Tokyo and Hong Kong and New York and Singapore and Berlin. And for both technological reasons and economic reasons and policy reasons, by the 1970s, financial markets became too big to control. And so capital controls became either difficult or impossible to implement. The Bretton Woods monetary order couldn't be sustained without them, and it collapsed. Right. And similar stories could be told about many of the other unique component parts of the Bretton Woods order. The greater integration of markets impeded or at least restricted the ability of national authorities to maintain nationally specific policies without taking into account their international implications. We had our own experience with this in the 1980s, when, starting in 1981, the U.S. began to run massive budget deficits. Now, the U.S. had always anticipated the implications of large-scale budget deficits as being more or less purely domestic, right? That is, that you run big budget deficits, you may worry about crowding out private investment, things along those lines. What happened in the, over the course of the early and mid-1980s was, as we ran big budget deficits, we funded those by borrowing hundreds of millions of dollars from the rest of the world. So the U.S. became a very large international borrower, and that began to impose very significant constraints on American economic policy, which may sound familiar for those of you following the events of the last 7 or 8 years. We did the same thing starting in 2001, ran large budget deficits, which led to enormous, you know, $500 billion to $1 trillion worth of borrowing from the rest of the world over the course of that 6 or 7 years. But the fact that the world economy was as integrated as it had become by the 1980s meant that the international implications of American domestic policy could no longer be ignored, even by the United States. So the U.S., in the terms of economists, was now had to be analyzed as if it were a small, open economy. It could no longer be thought of as a self-contained economy that could go its own without taking into account the international implications of its actions. Right? Meanwhile, another component part, remember I started by saying some economic, some geopolitical, another component part of the decay of the Bretton Woods system was geopolitical. The Cold War gradually came to an end, gradually and then rapidly, over the course of the 1980s, and at some level, while the end of the Cold War made the U.S. even more predominant, we went from a bipolar world to a unipolar world. The other component part, the other implication of the end of the Cold War was whatever geopolitical component there had been to European or Japanese or other countries' commitment to an American-led international economy was now a lot less relevant. Right? It might have made sense for countries in Western Europe or other parts of the world to subordinate their economic interests or some of their economic interests to American concerns at a time when they were part of the American-led alliance against the Soviet-led alliance, but there was no more Soviet-led alliance, no more geopolitical incentives to compromise with American interests on economic issues. And so the end of the Cold War also played a role in the winding down of that Bretton Woods system. So, where do we stand now and where might we be going? I think as the Bretton Woods system ended over the course of the 1980s, we moved into a new era. And again, I don't want to be too committed to or wedded to buzzwords, but I think we can use the word economic globalization to describe this new era, an era in which the world economy is much more tightly integrated than it was in the Bretton Woods system, that in which the spread of economic integration is pretty much global, which it was not during the Bretton Woods system. We talk about the international economy, and the Bretton Woods system was really 25 or so advanced industrial economies. The developing countries were never part of it. Of course, the communist countries were never part of it. China was never part of it. But globalization today really is pretty much global. That is, since the 1980s, the developing countries, almost all of them, have dramatically reduced their trade barriers and opened their borders to the rest of the world economy. And, of course, since 1990, before then in the case of China and a few other countries, since 1990, the formerly centrally planned economies have thrown themselves with a great deal of enthusiasm, in most instances, into the world economy. So we have a world economy which really is a world economy, and it is much more integrated than anything in the Bretton Woods system. Financial flows are an order of magnitude greater than they were in the 1970s. International trade is almost an order of magnitude greater than it was in the 1970s. The number of countries involved in international trade, international finance, is 3 or 4 times as great as it was in the 1970s and even in the 1980s, involved in a major way. And that globalized international economy, again, has some extraordinary accomplishments to mark. To me, among the most extraordinary, the very, very rapid pace of economic development in countries like China and India. I mean, if we look back, I think when people look back on this period in world history, they will probably identify as the most striking phenomenon the rise of China and, to a somewhat lesser extent, India. And that's not only an important economic development, it's an important social and human development as well, because that's, you're talking here about well over 2 billion people, well over a third of the world's population, who for decades and decades were essentially removed from the world economy, suddenly joining the world economy. And not only joining the world economy, but experiencing some of the most rapid rates of growth that one can imagine. Not only experiencing some extraordinarily rapid rates of growth, but experiencing an extraordinary increase in the real living standards. Right? Back in 1979, 30 years ago, something on the order of two-thirds of the Chinese population lived below what the World Bank has defined as the absolute poverty line, which is about $1.50 a day. Right? Two-thirds of the Chinese population, and about two-thirds of the Indian population as well. Today, less than 5% of the Chinese population lives below that absolute poverty line. Right? That's about 1 billion people who have been lifted out of absolute poverty in China, and you know it's a smaller number in India, about 400 million. Right? None of that, I think, could have taken place without China and India having access to the world's markets, to the world's capital, to the world's technology. So globalization has played a major role in remaking the international economic order. There are new centers of economic influence, the European Union as an entity, Japan, China, an indication of that, by the way, for those of you following these things, is that it's now pretty much universally recognize that the G7 and G8, which used to be seen as the arbiters of international economic cooperation, has now been officially recognized as irrelevant and replaced by the G20, which includes countries like Brazil and Russia and India, China, South Africa, and Mexico. So there are more and more important economic actors, and there are tighter and tighter international economic constraints. Both of those are important. Both of those are different from the Bretton Woods system. Both of those are associated with an increasing divergence among the major economic actors on economic affairs. Perhaps the most striking example of this in the current financial crisis is that we could divide the world, we could divide the major economic powers into two broad groups. You've got the debtors and you've got the creditors. And we're one of the debtors, along with the UK and Spain and Ireland and some of the other former deficit countries. And China and Japan, Germany, and others are the creditors. And the economic interests of debtors and creditors, as you well know, are not always aligned. Right? The economic interests of China and the US, the economic interests of Germany and the US, have diverged in very important ways. And although there is a common interest in trying to maintain a semblance of international economic order, financial order, monetary order, trading order, on many, many dimensions, right, there are increasing divergences in the interests of the major economic players. Given the new security environment, I think the willingness of others to follow the American lead has declined very substantially, and a new multipolar international economy is emerging. So that's what's happened in the international order. Within the U.S., I think there also have been some very important changes. You know, when the U.S. was playing this leadership role, it was a time of great optimism. Right? So whether may not have been a great enthusiasm about the world economy, it became so. By the 50s, public opinion really had turned around. But the U.S. was optimistic about its own future, and it was optimistic about its role in the world, and it became optimistic about the world economy. In fact, I can remember 10, 15 years ago when the term globalization started to be used, it was almost always used in the U.S. in a positive way. There was sort of a globalization euphoria, as evidenced by Tom Friedman and other popular books on the phenomenon. Today, as I think we know, the term globalization is almost only used with a negative connotation. And there is, as public opinion polls show, a very great skepticism about the world economy. In fact, Americans there's a standard poll that's used to try to gauge this. It's done by Pew. In 2007, which is the last poll before the crisis, so this doesn't pick up anything about the crisis. In 2007, when asked about their views on international trade, of all 47 nations surveyed, Americans were the most negative. As American opinion on international trade was more negative than that of any other of the 47 countries surveyed, even France, right, which is always the league leader. Right, so nothing against France, but the fact is that the French have always been the most skeptical about international trade. The U.S. has now exceeded France by a long shot. The main reason for this, I think, those of us who analyze these things, is that rightly or wrongly, many Americans perceive globalization, international trade, as closely related to one of the great social realities of the modern United States, which is the continuing deterioration in the income distribution, the growing gap between rich and poor. A lot of economic debate over this, but most Americans think that opening our borders to products from countries like China and India, that is, with billions of low-skilled, low-wage workers, puts downward pressure on American wages, And by the same token, opening the world's investment opportunities to American banks and corporations puts upward pressure, if you need to put pressure on it, exerts an upward force on the wages and salaries of the very rich. So there is a very widespread view that globalization is associated with an increasing gap between rich and poor. And it might surprise you, you know, this is not a universal view. That is, if you ask similar questions in other countries, not everyone thinks that globalization is associated with an increasing gap between rich and poor. Americans are not unique in this, but they are at the extreme of views. And again, some public opinion numbers, 2/3 of Americans think that the distribution of income and wealth in the U.S. has become less fair over the last 10 to 15 years. More than 4/5 of those ascribe this first and foremost to globalization. Right? 2/3 of Americans think that globalization is bad for job security, and almost 2/3 think it's bad for job creation. Now, if you ask them, are you in favor of trade liberalization or globalization, we still have a slight plurality in favor because presumably the positives outweigh the negatives. But still, the U.S. is really at the extreme of negative views on globalization. Right? There's also, going back to another theme that I've mentioned, pretty much the disappearance of any pre-existing national security motivation for American involvement in the world economy. Remember, we justified our involvement in the world economy in the 40s and 50s and really until relatively recently as part of the Western alliance, as part of the bulwark of democracy in Western Europe, Japan, against the Soviet Union or against whatever the threat might have been perceived as being. So there was a pretty clear relationship between U.S. foreign economic policy and our national security policy. Right? But today, where does that justification go? People look and say, well, some people say, well, our principal national security concern is global terrorism, Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. And how does the level of our economic integration with some of the countries that have been most prominent in supplying those terrorists, how does that feed into that? I mean, our relationship with Saudi Arabia, our relationship with many of the oil-producing states, our dependence upon not only oil but now capital from many of these states, it's hard to square with the notion that this is inherently important to international security. Well, other people say, well, the real national security concern is the rise of China. But again, the country has become dependent upon Chinese goods and Chinese capital. So how do you square that with a legitimate set of national security concerns? So there's been a disconnect, a growing disconnect, I think, between the national security component of American foreign policy and our international economic commitments. The current situation is one in which there is great skepticism about the international economy in the U.S. There are grave reservations about America's role in the world economy and the rest of the world, and there is very little willingness elsewhere to simply follow the American leader for any non-economic or geopolitical reasons. That leaves me with the concluding question, which is, where are we headed? Well, I think, again, I'll go back to the survey of the short American century, the international economy that arose after World War II. That organized Bretton Woods system was based on a confluence of economic and political and geopolitical circumstances that were quite special. Right? The underpinnings of that American-led, American-built international economy were unusual, and they're gone. They're also very unlikely to recur. So that leaves us with a very different environment within which international economic affairs is carried out. Globalization today, the international economy today, will have, I think, to rest not on some geopolitical considerations, not on some presumption of American predominance or leadership, but perhaps on an actual consensus in favor of sustaining an open international economy, both within countries and among them. Right? Well, you might sort of say, well, it's probably healthy in the long run for the world economy to be organized on more consensual grounds, and I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. But healthy as it may be, it's unprecedented. Right? Because remember, the classical gold standard economy of the 19th and early 20th century was predicated on common agreement among the major powers in favor of an open world economy. But those major powers were not democratic. Right? Almost none of them were democratic, and the ones that were democratic were barely democratic by our current standards. It was a consensus among narrow elites that kept the gold standard working, that kept the international economy of the 19th and early 20th century working. It was not some consensual democratic order. Right? The international economy organized by the U.S. after World War II was consensual in a sense, but it was also predicated on a gradualism and a compromise and a restriction to a relatively narrow part of the world. That's not the case today. So the strains, I certainly hope that that such a consensual international economy can be obtained. That is, it's possible that an international economy organized by the common consent of democratic nations, right, can be maintained. And I certainly hope so. But it's not something that, for which we have a lot of precedent, a lot of prior experience. And if we look around the world today, the strains that are increasingly evident in the current crisis really raise questions about the sustainability of an integrated world economy when today most of the principal nations are democratic and when the ability of any one nation to force its will on others is strictly limited. To put it somewhat differently, that short American century in the world economy was very successful at rebuilding an open order out of the really disastrous ruins of a failed international economy in the interwar period. Its success fundamentally changed the world economic order and created the preconditions for a globalized international economy that we live in today. But those fundamental changes made a lot of the organizing principles of the Bretton Woods system obsolete. And the challenge I think that we face today is to see if the world and the U.S. can continue and deepen the successes of an open world economy in very profoundly changed conditions. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for coming.
Good job.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Harvard University professor Jeffrey Frieden titled The Short American Century, 1941 to 2008, Contrasting Views of the Era of American Dominance. Tonight's lecture was presented by the International History Institute at Boston University. Professor Frieden was introduced by Boston University Professor of History and International Relations, Andrew Basevich. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ryan Peterson. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.